Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. It's day 22 of the federal government shutdown. In 10 days, should this shutdown continue, it will become the longest in history. Both sides are dug in. Not only are they refusing to budge, but the White House is refusing to meet with recalcitrant Democrats, and both sides are blaming the other. It's like a game of chicken, but with higher stakes and with real lives being impacted as federal workers go unpaid, government services and facilities remain closed, including tourist attractions, and as premiums for health insurance obtained through the Affordable Care Act are set to rise substantially. But even though the government is shut down, there are things happening around the country, including Republican efforts to redistrict prior to the 2026 midterms to cement their control of Congress. We're going to get an update on all of that and more as we visit once again with two Capitol Hill reporters. Danielle Battaglia is the congressional correspondent for the Charlotte Observer and the Raleigh News and Observer. Reuben Jones is a Washington reporter covering both North Carolina and national politics from D.C. for Spectrum News One. And here to provide some perspective, to referee, to let me ask difficult and uncomfortable questions of and talk about the political maneuvers that we are witnessing is Dr. Michael Bitzer, who is a professor of history and political science at Catawba College. Hi, everybody. Welcome back.
Good to be with you.
Good morning. Reuben, I'm going to begin with you. Legislators in Raleigh are back this week, even though they have yet to pass a budget in Raleigh. They have taken up redistricting. Donald Trump asked Texas to redraw districts so that Republicans could maintain control of Congress. Other states, including ours, seem to be hopping on the bandwagon. Did he specifically ask for this from North Carolina, or are they just doing this out of the goodness of their hearts?
Publicly, I don't know if he specifically said North Carolina, but I mean, behind the scenes, I think that's probably what happened. I mean, there's been so much discussion, and it's sort of been indicated that President Trump didn't just want Texas to do it. He wanted any Republican state that could change their map to go ahead and do it.
And Danielle, remind us, what is the margin in the U.S. House and Senate in terms of the division between Democrats and Republicans? And talk about what will be needed either for Democrats to gain control or Republicans to maintain it.
It is very, very small, and I don't have the exact number in front of me. We've had a couple, we've had two deaths and a resignation that has changed the numbers a little bit, but it's like less than 10 people between the Democrats and the Republicans, with Republicans in the majority. So it is a known fact that when there is a sitting president and a midterm election, the sitting president's party tends to do worse in the midterm. And that's something they're trying to get ahead of, kind of by cheating the system here and redistricting different states so that they can give the upper hand to Republicans.
Of course, California is trying to counter Texas, Reuben. It remains to be seen whether they will, because it's up to the voters, and they have a nonpartisan board that decides how to draw districts in California. They'd be giving that up to make this happen, to draw it for Democrats. But I think no matter what happens in North Carolina, whether they pass this or not, we either have they're only going to gain one seat if they pass this. Does that help at all? I mean, is it just every seat helps?
Every seat helps. I mean, when you have a majority that is so narrow right now, there's a reason that some of these states that are only picking up one seat are changing their maps. North Carolina is one of numerous states that are undergoing this or considering undergoing this. A number of Republican states, but also a number of Democratic states, where you're going to see perhaps the biggest changes would be your California, where they would pick up five Dems, Texas, where they'd pick up five Republicans. We're watching places like Florida, New York, although they couldn't do it until 2028. Keep an eye on Ohio and a number of other states as well. But one seat, Mike, really does make a difference. And it makes a big difference also just symbolically, because it means that North Carolina would likely not only currently have 10 Republicans and four Democrats, you'd move up to 11 Republicans and just three Democrats representing the state, likely, if this map does pass.
So, Michael, we are witnessing what have been described as attacks on democracy on a daily basis coming from the Trump White House. Trump's request to Texas to redistrict in order to deliver him enough votes to maintain congressional control in the midterms smacks of what he did in Georgia in 2020 when he asked the state to find him enough votes to win that election. Can it be said that these gerrymanders in places like Texas and Missouri and California, likely North Carolina, possibly Georgia, Louisiana, Ohio, Utah, could it be said that they are also attacks on democracy?
I think so. I think if you're trying to tilt the game of political power to assure yourself of continuing political control of an institution of government, yeah, this is where we are. And we are in such divided and polarized and now authoritarian tendencies in American politics that this is part of the new game of politics, if you will. How can I stack the deck to be able to keep my party in political control thanks to the voters who are party loyalists? If you draw the lines and know where the geography of polarized politics is, you can pretty much predetermine what the district will do before the voters cast one single ballot.
So we had this big march, this big No Kings march over the weekend, where I think 7 million plus people turned out around the country. And there's, what 300 million people in the country. So 7 million people, although you can say it was a big protest and the biggest in history, not so much. But if they do these redistricting successfully, these redistricting efforts around the country, Michael, is it possible for Democrats to turn out and vote in enough numbers to vote past these attempts to block Democrats from holding office? Is it possible?
It's possible. Tell me what the dynamics are like maybe a little under a year from now. How big is kind of the generic ballot? What kind of leaning towards the Democrats for voting preferences will be? And then how does that match up with how these districts are built and if they can overcome the predetermined dynamics? I mean, for example, with the first congressional district here in North Carolina, that's going to now shift from basically a 50-50 district to potentially a 56% Republican district. That's going to take a lot of movement in the electorate to push the bounds to get to that 56% Republican and overcome it.
Ruben, you wrote about this for Spectrum News' website yesterday about gerrymandering attempts in North Carolina, and you made mention of the fact that according to nonpartisan analysis from the Princeton Gerrymandering Project, which works, I think, around the country to spot these gerrymanders and also to reverse them, they say, based on partisanship fairness, North Carolina is one of a dozen states with an F grade. In fact, this map is going from an F to a bold-faced F. What does that mean?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what you go below an F. I guess an F minus. But I mean, North Carolina is bad when it comes to gerrymandering, according to the Princeton Gerrymandering Project, but also just looking at the map in terms of, you look at 2024 in the election, President Trump beat Kamala Harris by about 3 percentage points. But when you look at the congressional delegation, you've got a vast majority of Republicans representing the state and not Democrats. So look, the Princeton Gerrymandering Project does some objective work here to look at the impact of political and racial gerrymandering. But at the end of the day, does it matter? Because you've got state Republicans that are being incredibly blunt with why they're doing this. They're not hiding this. They're saying, we are adding another Republican seat because we want to protect President Trump's majority in Congress.
Which has led liberals, there's Ned Barnett, who writes the liberal opinion column in the Charlotte Observer this morning, essentially says that the Republicans don't believe in democracy. Can that be said, Michael, given what's going on around the country? Is it true that they don't believe in democracy? They want authoritarianism?
A challenging question yet again.
Thank you.
I think what the game that I think about when it comes to American politics is, if you're in power, you want to stay in power. And if you can tilt the game to your advantage, if you can construct the rules, if you can construct the courts, the fields that we play on to your advantage, Certainly, that's a dynamic. This has been evident in American political history for a very long time, since the founding of our Democratic Republic. Gerrymandering has always been here. It is the most political activity in American politics, if you will. I think what Republicans are more leaning towards is the strongman authoritarian concept, and they've got it in their president. The question is, will the people, we the people, stand up to this or accept it? This is going to be a real test for American democracy and Americans and America's republic.
And it should be said that as long as these gerrymanders around the country are based on politics, they're completely constitutional, according to the Supreme Correct. Court, which appears to be a flaw in our system. We're talking about things going on in Washington and how things going on in the states are affecting what's going on in Washington this morning on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. So following up on what Michael just said, Danielle, there are those in that say Congress has effectively neutered itself by ignoring its constitutional responsibility to act as a check against the executive branch. And there are those who are warning that Republicans are warning Republicans that if these gerrymanders attempts are successful and they're allowed to happen, that they're not going to like it when the shoe is on the other foot. But if these gerrymanders are successful, will the shoe ever be on the other foot?
I mean, it goes back to what Michael was saying, right? It depends on what the electorate does. If the electorate can overcome the way that the system is being stacked right now, it's possible that we could elect Democrats. It's not likely, but it's possible. But right now, it seems like we are setting up a system where Republicans will maintain the majority in both chambers and the presidency.
Well, and, go ahead. I was just going to say, I mean, I think that there's a couple ways that gerrymandering changes, right? So one is through Congress, and there is legislation in Congress to get rid of gerrymandering or put in place a more federalist system when it comes to independent redistricting commissions. That has not moved anywhere. There's state plans to do that as well. That has not moved anywhere. But we have seen numerous states adopt these independent redistricting commissions. The problem is places like California and New York are considering getting rid of them. Now, the other thing is that where we have seen influence in terms of creating maps or tweaking maps is on the state Supreme Court level. And so that is where courts have come in and said, this map is gerrymandered. We do not believe it's fair, and we are going to redraw it. We saw that in North Carolina, which resulted in a 7-Democrat, 7-Republican split on their map. Then the court changed, and the map went back to being solidly Republican. So there are ways where this process does change, but it doesn't always fall into place.
So this redraw that they're attempting to do here in North Carolina changes the shape and makeup of the state's first congressional district primarily. And Danielle, you wrote about one of the potential candidates who declared prior to the redraw, Eric Rouse of Kinston. Well, now that we know the contours of this map, will there be other Republicans and or Democrats who emerge who will likely throw their hats into the ring before 2026?
I'm hearing a lot behind the scenes about potential people who could run. There's a lot of maneuvering going on right now. We don't have we don't have the map solidified. So that's the first step, is getting that map chosen, picked, solidified. Eric Rouse is that lawmaker. He is the Lenoir County Commissioner, which is interesting in itself because he chose to run and then got drawn out of his district.
When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about congressional redistricting here and around the country and what that may mean for Congress going forward, but also, obviously, the federal shutdown and the role of the Epstein files may be playing in all of this and more. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Habitat Charlotte Region. Since 1983, Habitat Charlotte Region has partnered with more than 5,000 families through financial education, homeownership, and critical home repair. More information at habitatcharlotteregion.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about goings-on or the lack of goings-on in Washington and some of the things happening in the states that impact Washington with three people who know it well. Danielle Battaglia is a congressional correspondent for the Charlotte Observer and the Raleigh News and Observer. Reuben Jones is a reporter covering North Carolina and national politics for Spectrum News One. And Dr. Michael Bitzer is with us. He's a professor of history and political science at Catawba College. In states, Michael, where these congressional district redraws are taking place, they're doing them outside of the normal redistricting time period, which usually falls after the release of census material. We have new numbers every 10 years with the census, and by law they have to redraw the districts to reflect that. We don't have new numbers for this census. So what makes this legal?
Well, it's legal because they're using the numbers from 2020 that were then used in 2021 to create those sets of maps and so forth and so on. So, you know, even though we are now 5 years out from the census, they're still using the data that is from 2020. And yes, North Carolina has grown. Yes, populations have shifted as well, but they're using what is legal in terms of the data from the census to create these new maps.
Reuben, in reporting on what the Princeton Gerrymandering Project had to say about our new map, which gave it a bold-faced F as a grade, what does that mean for voters? Does it shift the focus to the primaries? Is that what it does?
Yeah, very much. It means that your vote matters the most in a primary if you're in a district where it is just, I mean, overwhelmingly Republican or overwhelmingly Democrat. So the problem is that a lot of people don't vote in the primary elections. So it is incredibly important if you want your voice heard to vote in the primary and still vote in the general election. The other place, of course, you have your voice heard is in a statewide race, governor, state Supreme Court, Senate, and that is not impacted by gerrymandering.
And according to that article that you wrote, this means that voters lose influence in the general election in U.S. House races where these gerrymanders have occurred, Michael. And it was reported this morning by the same liberal columnist in the Charlotte Observer, that Ned Barnett, that Paul Newby, our Chief Justice of the North Carolina Supreme Court, says, well, the Constitution says we need to have fair elections, but they don't have to be free elections, but they don't have to be fair. Is that true?
Yes. I mean, if you think about what fair means, most people would say, well, however the state votes, that should be the proportionality of the distribution of congressional seats. And that has never been a context or a dynamic that has been evident in North Carolina politics. It's because we have a first-past-the-post system. If you win with one more vote than the candidate who comes in second, you get 100% of that seat. We don't have proportionality in American politics. We can go that route, but that would require some major rule shifting and changes that I don't foresee happening anytime soon.
Daniel, what's the scuttlebutt behind the scenes on Capitol Hill about all these redistricting efforts in Texas and California and now North Carolina and elsewhere? What are they talking about this behind the scenes?
I think it depends on which party you're on. For the Republicans, they're happy to see these lines get redrawn to help their party. For Democrats, they're frustrated by what they're seeing. But then you have the states like California where they are trying to go along with it and change their own states to match it. So there's a lot of different conversations happening on how to make this work for both parties.
It's also, Mike, I think, sort of personal in a sense. When you talk about the Democrat, Don Davis, who's been most impacted by this, he lives in Snow Hill, Greene County, and that county moves into a different district under this redistricting. So he has a tough decision to make, which is, do I continue to run in a district that I no longer live in and move or stay in it, or do I switch districts completely and run over there? And it's a tough decision. And keep in mind, too, that North Carolina lawmakers have seen, Michael will know this better than me, I think it's six maps in 10 years or something like that. And so how do you keep track of where the lines are, what counties, what people you represent?
And also, how do voters?
This is nothing out of the ordinary for North Carolina. We've had this since the 1990s.
It hurts the people in office, but it also hurts voters, because if you like the person representing you and they're no longer in your district, then you have to figure out a whole new ball game. The other aspect of this first congressional district in North Carolina is that it has elected black representatives for 30 straight years. And that's because the U.S. Supreme Court has said that states with a history of state-sponsored racial discrimination, which we have had in the past, must create a district that will elect black representatives. And the makeup of District 1, as it stands, has the highest percentage of black voters in the state. Political gerrymandering is completely constitutional, completely legal, or so says the Supreme Court. But racial gerrymandering is not. This seems to be a situation which occurs a lot in North Carolina, where the both intersect. Is that going to be a legal problem down the road, Michael, or anybody for them?
well, we've got to wait a couple months for a court case coming out of the U.S. Supreme Court from Louisiana, which could conceivably basically gut the Voting Rights Act and basically free the states from having to consider race in redistricting. I think that's the case that everybody is watching. And if that happens, then potentially you could see, particularly across the South, a whole new round of redistricting to basically eliminate the majority-minority districts that elect a black representative and could potentially benefit the Republicans as well.
Yikes. Since the court channel challenge seems to be the only avenue that Democrats have available to them should this new map in North Carolina pass, can it go through the courts, get a decision either way prior to 2026 and the midterms? Because the primary, I believe, is in March.
Primaries in March and candidate filing is in December. So we've got a very narrow window. I mean, my expectation is that it would be challenged. The map, if passed by the House today or tomorrow, would be challenged in court. But they will probably let that map continue on as the court case works its way through the courts and ultimately the decision by the U.S. Supreme Court probably early next year.
Why wouldn't they issue an injunction?
They could and keep the current map in play,
right.
But the courts are typically loath to really try and interfere in the electoral process. We've seen that in the past, and particularly the congressional primary get moved back later to allow court challenges to work its way through. But it's anybody's guess at this point what's going to happen.
Okay, so Ruben, today marks the 22nd day of the federal government shutdown, and there doesn't seem to be any urgency to reopen it on either side of the aisle, and both sides of the aisle are blaming the other. What are you hearing in the halls of Congress? Is there any behind-the-scenes discussion of the consequences of what's going on?
Not hearing a lot in the halls of Congress because the House hasn't been here for weeks.
Right.
The Senate is here. But there's not a heck of a lot going on because they're stalled here. And it's really sort of a standstill in terms of what happens next. Yes, there is concern about the impacts of this to federal workers, many of them here in D.C., but also you've got thousands and thousands in North Carolina who aren't getting a paycheck. And as this goes on longer and longer, you worry about people who might call out sick. Of course, we think back to the last long shutdown, and you had TSA workers calling out, and you had the long lines. There was concern about military members and what that means in terms of pay for them. And then another discussion happening here is, why are lawmakers getting paid when other federal workers aren't getting paid? And so that's another concern. But it's just a standstill, Mike, and I don't know what happens next.
Yesterday, House Speaker Mike Johnson was asked a question at a press conference about this impasse, and I want to play both the question and his response, or part of his answer, and then get your reaction.
Some of your members are kind of uncomfortable with being out on recess for a month, so why not bring everybody back, work through the appropriations that you haven't passed yet, and sort of do an end run around Hakeem Jeffries?
Yeah, so couple things. First of all, 99.5% of the House Republicans understand exactly what we're doing. They agree with it. We talk regularly. We'll have another conference call later today. They have been out doing very essential, very important work in their districts, and their constituents appreciate that. I mean, they've been everywhere because, as Chairwoman McClain said, they've got to help cover the bases for the crisis that's been created by the Democrats. Now, the calculus and the strategy on when I bring everybody back, people have said, are you going to change your strategy? And I've said to you all very plainly in good faith, we don't have a political strategy here. I don't have a strategy. We're just trying to do the right thing. We did what has been customary here and passed a simple CR. Again, this is really important, and it should be a headline in your journals as well. This is the first time in history that any party has shut down the government over a clean CR. It's a clean CR.
So a CR is a continuing resolution, which is how we fund the government in piecemeal over time and arrive at budgets. But how much of that is true, Ruben and Danielle? Is this a clean CR? And either way, what is a clean CR? Let's talk about that first, Danielle. What is a clean CR?
So a clean CR basically is a resolution to fund the government at its current levels that doesn't have extra provisions in it. So like, say, one of the things the Democrats want right now is to extend tax credits that are in the Affordable Care Act. So if the Democrats were in charge, they could have put that in. Republicans could say they don't want it. That would, I don't think the term is dirty CR, but that would make it a dirty CR as opposed to a clean one. So it's basically those pieces that the one party or the other wants in a bill or into the CR that the opposite party wouldn't want to carry it through. So what they're saying is they have passed a bill that has no provision in it that would make them argue.
And so it's accurate. It is a clean CR. That's accurate.
From everything I've heard, yes. I don't believe they have anything in there that are making them fight. Now, what I will say is that Democrats weren't brought to the table to debate this with Republicans, and that has upset them. And there are provisions that they want to see accomplished through the CR, including those tax credits. They also want to see the cuts from the One Big Beautiful Bill with Medicaid. They want that brought back in. And so I think from their perspective, there are things that they wish were in this bill that they think is it's not clean because they have wants that they would like to push forward. So I think it's perspective.
So if you read The Art of the Deal, you have to have leverage. And that's the leverage. Democrats don't want to open the government back up until they get guarantees that these things will be fixed. And the White House says, open the government back up and then we'll talk about it. Ruben, is this kind of like, are the Democrats feeling that this is kind of like Charlie Brown, Lucy and the football?
Yeah, I mean, Democrats don't have a lot of power up here right now. So this is an opportunity where they can actually make an impact. And so we'll see if it pans out for them. But yeah, I mean, their big focus is on healthcare. And their bet is that as time goes on, more and more Americans are going to realize as these healthcare subsidies under the Obamacare Affordable Care Act exchange expire, that people are really going to feel the impact of this because we're talking about significant increases per month. Projections are, nonpartisan projections are, that millions of people are going to lose their health insurance. So Democrats are all in on healthcare right now and say this is the reason they're putting up a fight on this. And it's really their only outlet. Remember the last time this came up, Chuck Schumer, the minority leader in the Senate, got a lot of pushback from progressives and Democrats and said, why didn't you push back more? Why didn't you fight more? Why did you let the government stay open when there's so many concerns about what the Trump administration is doing? This time it's a different story.
Republicans have said that Democrats want to offer federal health benefits to illegal immigrants. The Democrats say that's not true. In fact, illegal immigrants, they say, don't have access to the Affordable Care Act, nor to Medicare or Medicaid. And they say the Republicans' big, beautiful bill will substantially increase premiums for those on the Affordable Care Act. And they want that rolled back. Daniel, where's the truth?
So the truth is that the only time that they have access to healthcare is when they have an absolute emergency. Otherwise, they are not getting healthcare benefits from the ACA or Medicaid or anything like that. So it is not true what Republicans are saying about the Democrats.
We're talking about the political circus that is Washington this morning on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Michael, I've heard that the difference in the politics that we're going through today and the politics of the 90s is the difference between route and destination. In the 1990s, Republicans and Democrats often agreed on a policy objective. They just didn't disagree on how to get there. They disagreed on the route. And now they don't agree on the destination. Democrats believe in affordable health care. Many, maybe it's true, I don't know, many, if not the majority of Republicans do not. And that's just one area. If you can't agree on the destination, is there a way forward?
It becomes extremely difficult. And I think it's not just the destination. It's, in my reading and interpretation of the polarized politics that we're in, it's more systematic. It is more ingrained. It is more fundamental. It's basic values. It's basic, you know, core beliefs about the role of government, about society, and what should be expected out of society. And I think that a lot of this is much deeper than just willingness to listen to the other side. It's about what each side brings and how they perceive things. And this is becoming harder and harder and harder with each passing day.
Daniel, Texas Republican Representative Chip Roy this week floated the idea of using the so-called nuclear option to end the shutdown to get around the Senate filibuster rules that require a 60-vote majority to reopen the government, or 60-vote majority on anything. Yesterday, The Hill reported that Pennsylvania Senator John Fetterman, a Democrat, would support using that option because the government Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, is running out of money and people need to eat. Those are his words. He called what's happening bad political theater. Doing an end run around the filibuster has always been a non-starter for people in both parties. Have you heard any discussion of that? I have 45 seconds.
That is actually the first time I've heard that. I'm not surprised the conversation's happening, but I had not heard that till you said it.
Why is the filibuster? Go ahead, Ruben.
Yeah, I mean, there is some discussion about it for sure from the Republicans. Remember, the Democrats were the ones that wanted to do this in the past. Now they don't want to do it. Senator Tillis, Danielle, correct me if I'm wrong, is adamantly against getting rid of the filibuster. And yeah. Remember, he's leaving the Senate. So I don't know if there's a support quite to get rid of the filibuster at this point.
It's always been difficult, would likely be difficult this time around. Although it seems, once again, unfair, the filibuster. A majority is a majority, but clearly that's not the case in the Senate. When we come back, the role of the Epstein files, the role of the Hatch Act, and more. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and the Gambrill Center at Queens, presenting Earthwise, a public series exploring our connection to nature through science, film, art, literature, and lived stories, part of their Connected Campus program. More at gambrillcenter.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. We're talking about Washington. The 22nd day of the federal government shutdown is underway. Reuben Jones is with us. He's a reporter of North Carolina and national politics for Spectrum News One. Danielle Battaglia reports on Washington, and she's the congressional correspondent for the Charlotte Observer and the Raleigh News and Observer. And Dr. Michael Bitzer is here, professor of history and political science at Catawba College. Some believe that the Epstein files are playing a role in lengthening this shutdown because the House has not been in session for weeks, and that's because if they come back, Mike Johnson, the Speaker of the House, has to swear in the new representative from Arizona, who happens to be a Democrat and would be the 218th vote in favor of forcing the release of the Epstein files. He says he won't do it until the House is back in session, although there is precedent for doing that. And now the Attorney General in Arizona has filed suit against Mike Johnson, saying that if he doesn't do it, they'll have a judge in Washington swear her in and get on with it. How much of this shutdown has to do with that, Ruben?
It depends who you ask. I mean, it is certainly a belief among Democrats and some Republicans that it has a big role in why Speaker Johnson has not brought Republicans back and has not sworn in Adelita Grijalva. So, and I think it's a belief among a decent amount of people in the country as well. Epstein files has been an issue that has divided the MAGA base a little bit on the with the president, and they are not completely in line with Speaker Johnson and even the president. They want to see more Epstein files.
The attorney general in Arizona, Michael, has said that she represents the new representative, whose name I will never learn, but Ruben clearly does know it. Ruben, what is it again?
Adelita Grijalva.
Good for you. that she represents 800,000 people in Arizona who are now currently not represented. She cannot do constituent services for these people, although I guess there's a staff on Capitol Hill mm-hmm. that might be able to do it. But is there precedent for this? Can the Speaker of the House legally deny a duly elected member of the House an opportunity to be sworn in?
That is so far deep in the weeds that I'm not sure I'm necessarily an expert on. I would say this, the House does have control over its membership. They can judge who is a member. They can expel members. They have that power. The Speaker has immense power and can hold this off for as long as he wants to. Conceivably, the courts can get involved, but this could become a separation of powers issue. We don't want one branch telling another branch what the internal dynamics can be. I'm just not, I don't know enough about the past in terms of bringing folks in. Sorry.
All the things that have been going on in the last, what is it, October, the last 10 months, are seem to be designed specifically to break government, to break the systems that are in place. Is that what's going on, Michael?
I think so.
It won't work. Isn't that spectacular?
Break it and not abide by the basic fundamental principles of what our American system is designed around. You know, the framers had a very important principle, and that is we're dividing government power up intentionally because we want the ambition of one branch to check, to put into place the other branches' ambitions as well. And when you don't have branches of government that are willing to stand up to another branch of government and say, whoa, wait a minute, this is going too far, you're violating that basic fundamental principle of American democratic republicanism. And this is the system that we get.
If this shutdown goes beyond November the 1st, Danielle, not only will it become the longest government shutdown in history, but Affordable Care Act premiums are scheduled to rise dramatically, I'm told, and really will begin to hit home for those people. And there are millions of people on this who don't really understand, because if they're not a government employee, this is not really affecting them. If you're not trying to go and tour the Smithsonian, this is not affecting you at the moment. But when your insurance premiums come due, and you have to make a decision, it will hit home, we are told. How dramatic are these increases likely to be, do you know? And is that what Democrats are counting on by drawing this out, that people will suddenly realize, oh my God, I have skin in this game?
It's substantial. I don't remember the number off the top of my head, but it was a substantial number that can make a lot of people lose their health care. It wasn't, you know, $100 sounds like a lot, but it wasn't a small amount. It was astronomical, and it's going to have a big effect. I think the other thing to remember is once we get past that 30-day mark, you are going to see some of those social safety net programs also whittle away with funding. And so you're talking SNAP program, you're talking WIC program, like those are going to start affecting the American people as well. And so the longer this goes on, the more we're going to see the impact back at home and not just in Washington.
During the shutdown, Michael, there were concerns about airport slowdowns, some of which are true because the TSA and the air traffic controllers are now working without pay. And with that in mind, the Secretary of Homeland Security, Kristi Noem, who oversees airport security operations, produced a video to be shown at TSA checkpoints and airports nationwide.
Democrats in Congress refuse to fund the federal government. And because of this, many of our operations are impacted, and most of our TSA employees are working without pay.
That's audio from that video that she produced, but all of the first part of that is true. Democrats are not solely to blame for this, as we have discussed, but some airports, including ours in Charlotte, refuse to show this video, and there is something called the Hatch Act, which prohibits executive branch officials from using their official authority to influence elections or engage in partisan political activity. Does this cross the line, Michael?
I think it does. I think when you're using your position to attack the other side politically, this is where the Hatch Act was designed, not to be, you know, the dynamic of the politicization of executive agencies, the bureaucracy. You know, we used to have the spoil system where presidents could literally appoint every federal employee because they were part of his political party. We moved away from that to the merit system, to the civil servant system. But, you know, what we have is the leaders of these executive branches, agencies, utilizing politics in trying to gain the upper hand in this. And my understanding is that the Charlotte Airport says these videos are meant, you know, the monitors are meant to direct people. It's not going to be a political dynamic at play.
And aren't we witnessing a lot of violations, and haven't we witnessed a lot of violations under both Trump administrations of the Hatch Act? And are we moving back to this political appointee system versus civil service? Aren't we moving back to that?
We are moving back intensely to the politicization of bureaucratic administrative agencies. I'm not an expert on how many violations specifically of the Hatch Act has occurred, but certainly these kinds of dynamics call into question when government is doing its job. Is it because you are a D or you are an R? And that has not been a principle since the late 1800s that we've operated on.
And this is another example, Ruben, of things being purposefully broken. And you did some reporting on this. Wouldn't any violation of the Hatch Act normally have to be investigated and or prosecuted by the executive branch and the Justice Department? Is that underway, or is it completely out of the realm of possibility that this Justice Department, that this executive branch, will investigate their own wrongdoing?
So it's a bit in the weeds here, but under the Biden administration, it was handled differently than it is now. So In this administration, Hatch Act complaints are reviewed by the Office of Special Counsel, but any violations by White House commissioned officers, my understanding is that would be cabinet secretaries, are referred to the president for appropriate actions. So, you know, don't expect really any violations of Hatch Acts maybe to be acted upon. The other thing to keep an eye on here, and I will say that that was normal procedure prior to the Biden administration as well. The other thing to keep an eye on here, because I talked to the former White House ethics attorney for George W. Bush, is not just violations of Hatch Act, but violations of the Anti-Lobbying Act, which prohibits appropriated funds to influence members of Congress. And the argument here is that when you are putting postings that say Democrats are to blame for the shutdown on your government-funded website, when you're putting videos, things that cost money with the intention of maybe influencing members of Congress, then you are violating this Anti-Lobbying Act.
Okay, well, and we're seeing that did happen at the beginning of the shutdown, where people's messages on their computers, on their emails, came back with the blaming the Democrats, something that the employees didn't do, but that their supervisors did. North Carolina Senator Tom Tillis voted against that so-called Big Beautiful Bill and then announced he would not seek re-election in 2026. Trump called this great news. But Tillis still has 2 years left, and he started to become more critical of the administration prior to deciding not to run. For instance, he voted to confirm Trump's nominee to be Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth. Since then, he said that Hegseth is out of his depth and amateurish in his approach. And that was before Hegseth lectured every admiral and general in the armed forces in that big meeting in, I think it was Quantico. Which of these approaches, Ruben, represents the real Tom Tillis? What does he really believe?
Well, all the reporting had been that Tillis was going to vote against Hegseth. And the reporting, I think it might have been the Wall Street Journal, was that there was agreement among a few Republicans that they were going to unite and vote behind Hegseth. And then that just did not pan out. And he did, in fact, vote for Hegseth. And now we're seeing all of his concerns publicly boil out. And so I'll let that speak for itself.
So Tillis has also been publicly struggling to understand the National Guard deployment to cities like Chicago and Portland. And he said this.
I believe the president is absolutely focused on making these dangerous cities safer. I reject any notion that Charlotte's on that list, by the way. So whether you're Democrat or Republican, bring it on. But I see 3.5 years from now, if we don't address the systemic problems, that what we've basically done is given a governor and mayor and city councilman a pass on failing to protect their people.
So Daniel, isn't he essentially, effectively in agreement with Trump on sending National Guardsmen to quell violence in Democratic cities where Trump says the leadership has failed? Isn't he in agreement with him?
He said in that same hearing that if that were to happen on his watch when he was House Speaker of North Carolina, he would feel like a failure as House Speaker, and that he feels like this is an issue that needs to be taken up at the ballot box. Like, we're not keeping our city safe. That needs to be, like, those people need to be held accountable. So it sounded, I'm not going to put words in his mouth, but it seemed like he was in agreement that the National Guard has a right to step in when they needed to. But if he was in charge of those communities, he would feel like he failed. And to do that is just putting a Band-Aid on a bigger systemic issue that needs to be addressed. And that was his main concern in this hearing, is if we keep allowing this to happen by bringing the National Guard in, are we covering up a bigger problem that needs to be addressed at the local issue or local level?
It's politics on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. But Michael, using military troops on U.S. soil, sending in the National Guard to places not requested by governors of states and in situations where there is arguably no threat to public safety or national security used to be something that we wouldn't even have considered it. It was anathema. Are those who see this as the moves of a president genuinely concerned with reduction of crime, as opposed to normalizing the sight of troops in our streets, particularly in advance of the midterm elections, are they being naive or are they being disingenuous?
I think that there's real concern expressed about if you have military troops roaming major urban areas that are democratically dominated in elections, you will have a stifling or a threat presence to be able to say, maybe you shouldn't show up to vote. There are some real concerns. And, you know, when we have this kind of an environment and this kind of willingness to insert from the federal level down to the local level, you know, I don't hear a lot about states' rights, and I don't hear a lot about the best power kept in American government is at the local level. Yeah, there are concerns, there are issues, but oftentimes they are blown so far out of proportion. If you only listen to the president's remarks, Portland apparently has burned to the ground because of all the crime and the issues. That's not the case. And it has not been. And I think the rhetoric is just as dangerous as the troops' presence as well.
We can all see this. You're on television, Ruben. We see what's going on in the streets of Portland, despite what Donald Trump says is going on the streets of Portland. Could this ultimately have an impact? Could this boomerang backfire on him and his supporters? Because we see it, and we're being told not to believe our own eyes. This is 1984. George Orwell.
Could be. I mean, if you look at it from a political lens, I guess you could say, well, cities tend to be more Democratic, rural areas tend to be more Republican. So maybe there's this assumption. But I mean, look, me and Danielle are in Washington. We were the first city to get National Guard. A lot of the rhetoric and language about D.C. was frankly not true. And so now we have seen National Guard. I see them every day on my way to work. And at first, it was a bit of a a shock. And frankly, I don't really know what they were doing because they didn't have a lot to do. Now they've sort of settled in. How it's being perceived is a real mixed bag, real mixed
bag. Yeah, it's been normalized. And that, I think, is probably the idea. Reuben Jones is a reporter of North Carolina politics and national politics for Spectrum News from Washington. Daniel Battaglia is congressional correspondent for the Charlotte Observer and the Raleigh News and Observer. Dr. Michael Bitzer is a professor of history and political science at Catawba College. Our all-star ribbon, blue ribbon panel this morning. Thank you for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.